Hello, we couldn't help but wonder, listeners. Seeing as we have a while before And Just Like That is back, Elise and I wanted to give you a listen to another project we've been working on. We couldn't help but wonder, still wondering. There, we discuss New York City-based rom-coms like When Harry Met Sally, You've Got Mail, Hitch, Trainwreck, Bros, Serendipity, Ghost. We cheat a little bit with Sleeps in Seattle, but also bonus episodes where we answer questions and do quick breakdowns of films like An Affair to Remember. We break them into 3 to 4 episodes, so the first episodes that we're going to share here are not spoilery at all. We hope you enjoy. Welcome to Still Wondering, Sleepless in Seattle, Part 1. Hey, Elise Castle.
Hey, Mike Jensen. But hold on really quick.
Sure.
Yesterday, I was in Chinatown, and then we started walking through Little Italy, and I was looking for the Sweetheart Wine and Liquor from Moonstruck. And I found the building, but now it's a restaurant. And then sometimes I stare at those buildings and I think, how did you become you?
Sure.
And that's all. And then we happened to walk a little bit further and I found Scout again. I didn't poop there, but I found it and it's in Manhattan again. So
back in Manhattan. That's nice.
That's all I wanted to share.
After the strange move to Brooklyn. Well, I at some point texted you today and said, I could be taking notes for 2 more days. So I'm going to resign myself to not being quite the Sleepers in Seattle expert that I want to be. I think I still have plenty of information. I think I still have plenty of interesting facts. And I think together we'll make this fun.
I just found out there was not one, but 2 Sleepless in Seattle musicals. And I didn't get nearly enough time to research those. So there's one that was called Sleepless in Seattle, the musical, that debuted at the Pasadena Playhouse in 2013. And then there's one called Sleepless, the musical, that's different, that was playing in London.
I didn't know they were different. I thought it was the same thing, just reworked. But I only did a little bit of research on that.
Yeah, I mean, they have different writers, so.
Yeah, I think that, it'd be interesting to, maybe we'll do a follow-up on this, but my understanding is that the first one didn't go well, and so the new writers were, like, it was the same producing team.
Okay.
But they were like, nah, let's try this again.
Okay.
But I'd be curious to know how it went. It, like, opened during COVID. Like, it opened in London in, like, 2020. Yeah, which feels like maybe that wasn't the best idea, but who knows how it actually turned out.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would love to know more. I would love to know. Anyway, yeah, I want to play the Rosie character.
Gotcha. So we're here to discuss, obviously, Sleepless in Seattle, a film that I have to say kind of slowly, or it's just like Sleepless in Seattle.
That's how I felt saying Little Italy.
Little Italy. And I blame myself. We've been very spotty on the DVD reading, but I'm going to go ahead and read the DVD description for this one because I have it in front of me. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan star in Nora Ephron's wonderfully romantic comedy about two people drawn together by destiny. Hanks stars as Sam Baldwin, a widowed father who, thanks to the wiles of his worried son, becomes a reluctant guest on a radio call-in show. He's an instant hit with thousands of female listeners who deluge his Seattle home with letters of comfort. Meanwhile, inspired in equal parts by Sam's story and by classic Hollywood romance, writer Annie Reid, Ryan, becomes convinced that it's her destiny to meet Sam. There are just 2 problems. Annie's engaged to someone else, and Sam doesn't know, yet, that they're made for each other. Co-starring Rosie O'Donnell, Rita Wilson, and Rob Reiner, Sleepless in Seattle, truly is the romantic comedy that started it all. You know, that's like the tagline on the front, too, the romantic film that started it all. I don't know how I feel about that.
But yeah, I think, especially because we're in the Reiner-Ephron-verse, did they sign off on, we're just not going to talk about When Harry Met Sally?
Yeah, kind of bizarre that you wouldn't classify When Harry Met Sally, if anything, as the one that started it all.
And I'm wondering if that's because this might be the 90s rom-com, but it's a similar trope. It follows the same formula. It kind of does the same thing. Maybe just because it was before You've Got Mail. I don't know.
Maybe.
Do you want to bring Rosie into the conversation with us, or do you think she's there?
She's behind me.
She's there.
Yeah, if she wants to say anything, she'll chime in.
Okay, the Rosie O'Doll is looking
for
at
those
me.
That don't know, I have a Rosie O'Doll that is actually visible behind me.
Mm-hmm. And something that I didn't get to bring up last time that I'm just noticing now that I would like to talk about is that kitty calendar behind you.
You know what? I've been waiting for one of my podcast wives, as it were, to notice. Yes, there is a kitty cat calendar behind me that was a present from our friend Annabelle. It was a birthday present.
Okay.
So I've had it since August. But can I tell you the part of the story that's a little bit, I mean, to say it's sad is very silly, but like I put it in a corner and was like, I'm excited for January when I get to put my cat calendar up. There is a page dedicated to September, October, yeah. November, and December. I had no idea.
I was going to say, if she bought you this for your birthday, which is in August, chances are it's an 18-month calendar or a 16-month calendar. Yeah, with those.
I'm so sad. At some point, I'll have to just like put up that page anyway.
I was hoping it was just like a free calendar you got from the ASPCA.
No, it was a birthday present.
I like it.
So here's some background. You know, there is so much background. There could be an entire miniseries made about the making of this film. So I've taken from many different sources and I will condense it and try to tell the story as succinctly as possible. This film is directed by Nora Ephron. This is her second film that she directed after a movie called This Is My Life. Story by Jeff Arch. He was living in Virginia teaching English and Taekwondo when he got the idea for this film. He specifically wanted to write a film where instead of the main couple bickering the whole time, they wouldn't even meet until the end of the film. So it's funny that like that was kind of the base idea of the film, but it's also the main reason why it was rejected so often. It was rejected by at least 6 different executives at 6 different studios because everyone said, well, what's the point of this film? They don't even meet until the very end. Like, where's the drama in that? Where's the romance in that? So his agent, a man named David Warden, submitted the script to Gary Foster in 1990. And he apparently had a policy where he would only read the first 25 pages of a script, but he just sort of found himself getting all the way to the end. He read the entire script and then like realized that he was crying. So he submitted it to TriStar executive Richard Fiskoff, I think is his name, whose staff actually, because you know, most of the executives don't read the scripts that come in. They have staff readers that read them, and the entire staff passed, or whoever read the script passed on it, like didn't even give it to this guy. But Foster basically begged him to read it, and he ended up optioning it. So, director Nick Castle, I believe no relation to you.
No, that's my brother. That's my uncle.
Oh, that is how exciting. So, he was supposed to have directed a film called Hook. And before it went into production, Steven Spielberg expressed interest in it. And of course, they were like, well, we're going to have him direct it instead. So, this was sort of a job offered to Nick Castle as like, sorry about Hook. Here's this other film for you to direct. And at this point in the production, it was really more of a romantic drama. There wasn't really any comedy to it. It was much more like sentimental, kind of dramatic. And like even to the point where like Sam, the Tom Hanks character, called the radio himself. Like it wasn't his son that called, it was him. And it was sort of determined that like, well, we don't think that any guy would do that. Or we don't think that like in this day and age, a single man would call up a radio. So basically, a man named David S. Ward was hired to rewrite it, and it was his idea to have the son call instead. And apparently at this point, Gary Foster was still unhappy with the script, and he had actually wanted Nora Ephron to be the one who rewrote it, but she wasn't available because she was directing a film. So when that film, This Is My Life, as I mentioned, came out, it was not a success. It did not do very well. And I feel like I saw it. I feel like I saw it a long, long time ago. It'd be interesting to revisit it.
April's movie.
Sure. I'm not sure it falls under any of our parameters, but okay. It could be interesting. So basically at this point, Nora was looking for a job. And, you know, script doctoring can be a pretty lucrative job that doesn't take very long to do. And in fact, basically, when she was given this script to kind of spruce up, she was like, give me 3 weeks, I'll have a new draft of it. So the problem is that, of course, what Nora Ephron does is comes in and she kind of makes it funnier. Like, she brings more of the jokes and she kind of, to Nick Castle's taste, he felt that she had, like, taken the sentimentality out of it. And so he decided that he didn't want to do the project anymore. So he left and instead went on to direct Dennis the Menace, which ironically would end up coming out on the exact same day as Sleepless in Seattle.
It is a much more sentimental film.
Is it? I've never seen it.
Just being,
yeah, I can't imagine.
I actually did see that in theaters and I don't remember. I saw this in theaters too and had no idea what was happening while I was watching it. So.
So in the end, we have story by Jeff Arch, screenplay by Nora Ephron and David S. Ward, who had written The Sting and its sequel. I think he might have won the Academy Award for The Sting. He also had done a film called Major League. He also had written a film called The Milagro Beanfield War, which literally I'd only ever heard of and truly thought it was about something that took place on the Milagro Beanfield. Nope, it's a name, Milagro Beanfield. So that was a thing that I discovered while doing my research for this. And Jeff Arch.
Kind of, I'm sure I've said this before, but my friend Ange that was convinced that it was the Wes Nile virus. Like, the first person to die from the virus was Mr. Wesley Nile.
That's pretty good. I listen to a lot of NPR. I'm not certain if it's Steve Inskeep or Steven Skeep. I don't know.
Wait till you see his picture. Your mind will be blown.
Probably. So there is commentary on this from Nora and her sister Delia. And they do very right up front say that Delia's title in this was associate producer. But she was actually the person who wrote the final draft of the script after it had gotten the green light, but people still weren't super happy with the script. So truly, Delia probably should have gotten another screenwriting credit, but she's in this as a producer. And we start Graveside in Chicago.
So I just want to say from the beginning, I know we discussed this on our last bonus episode, you know, that this isn't technically a New York City rom-com, but this is a New York City rom-com. From the moment it starts, it has major New York City rom-com energy. I think just Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan, Nora Ephron, like in general. And that was the first thing I wrote. But we are in Chicago. And yeah, we're at a funeral and, you know, he's saying mommy got sick. Tom Hanks is saying to this boy, and they're at a cemetery. And I just wrote, well, this starts out sad. Did we pick another bad one? So Tom Hanks and son are at the cemetery. This starts out sad. The son, Jonah, is played by Ross Malinger, who is no longer an actor. He is now a car salesman in L.A. And there's a lot of when you Google, like, whatever happened to the kid from Sleepless in Seattle? That's what happened. And I just thought, I felt like this might be a conversation they should have had before this moment. You know, like, we're going to go to your mom's funeral. I'll tell you what happened later. Like, because he's explaining mommy got sick. But maybe they already had it and he's just letting us know. And then I thought, what's happening? And then we pan to more people and there's everyone else.
We pull back and see the skyline and a small crowd. So I think that it's not so much that he's saying it to this boy who we assume is his son, that he's talking sort of to the crowd. And part of his thing of being like, it isn't fair, but if you start asking why, you'll go crazy. And, you know, I didn't do a whole lot about some of the people that we've already covered, but I did think it was worth noting that this is Tom Hanks post Big. And post Big, he had done Punchline, The Burbs, Joe versus the Volcano, and The Bonfire of the Vanities. And none of those were successful.
Yeah, haven't seen any of them.
I've seen almost all of them. I've never seen The Bonfire of the Vanities, but I know that they were all kind of considered flops. And, you know, he had Turner and Hooch that was in there as well, and which did financially do well, but it was like him and a dog. So I'm not sure that... I'm wondering where Tom Hanks was at as far as his career. Now, I will say this is his first film post A League of Their Own. So he was coming off of a relatively large hit.
Rosie.
Yeah, we have a bit of A League of Their Own connection that's going to happen here. And we get to Rita Wilson in the kitchen explaining how to heat up food in the microwave.
Mm-hmm. Who is Tom Hanks' real wife?
So they'd been married for 5 years at this point. Do we ever find out what the relationship is here?
I think just friends. I think they're like friends of theirs, unless they were all in a polycule, but I think they're just friends.
So they're not. And I think that's hilarious. And we'll get to when I find out who they are, because they never identify who these characters are ever in the screenplay.
No, they don't. I mean, we find out that her name is Susie, and we assume that Victor Garber, aka Mark Kasabian from the Kasabian Gallery, aka Greg, is Susie's husband. Unless they're all family? I don't know. You know something I don't know.
Yeah, we'll get there. I will say that she had already been in the industry for... Rhea Wilson had already been in the industry for over 20 years. But my biggest discovery here was that she had previously been a dancer in the film Teen Witch.
Kickball
Change. Which is a movie that I was obsessed with. Yeah. And then it took me a minute to recognize Victor Garber. I was like, oh, that's Victor Garber over there. Because I was trying to not look up too much as far as like finding out who characters were ahead of time. I was kind of, which I feel like you're good at that, and maybe I should go ahead and be the one that just like looks up the stuff.
Well, the reason I'm good at it is you buy most of these movies and I rent most of these movies through Amazon Prime. And when you rent something or watch something on Amazon Prime, when you pause it, it pops up who is in each scene.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense.
So it tells you at the bottom of the screen what song is playing, who's in each scene. So then what I usually do is at that moment, I look them up. I wouldn't have known that that was Rita Wilson and Victor Garber.
So now we're at an office. Mm-hmm. And I will include here that originally in the script, and I believe they even filmed this, Meg Ryan's character was also living in Chicago at the same time that they both were starting their journey in Chicago and then would head off in separate directions. He would head off to Seattle because of his wife passing away, and she would head off to the East Coast because of a breakup. But basically, it was just deemed that it felt almost inappropriate that we were like comparing these two things, that like he had experienced a death and that she was going through a breakup. So they just were like, let's just scrap all of that. We'll catch up with her later.
And there is that Nora Ephron thing that happens with these films. Like, if you remember, and you've got mail, there was like the clickety clack and the sending of things like that. That was the artwork. And in this one, we constantly see a map of the U.S. with like airplane flying over it.
Yes. Well, definitely. I do definitely have notes about that. Okay. When we get to the opening credits, because I thought it was I have opinions.
Oh, yeah. We're not there yet.
So we have a coworker giving Tom a card for his shrink, at which point Tom brings out. I still have Miss Tom because once again, I was doing the you thing where I didn't know the character's name quite yet. And Tom brings out all the cards he's received, including one involving cancer. So I had the moment of like, OK, I guess that the wife must have passed from cancer.
Same thing. And this person that's giving him the card is Rob, played by Tom Rhys Farrell. So when you're saying Tom, I'm thinking, Tom, gotcha. Tom.
And he says that work is the only thing that will see you through this, and which feels very cynical. And he basically says that they need a change.
Work hard. Work will save you. Work is the only thing that will see you through this. Don't mind him. He's just a guy who's lost his wife.
What I think we really need is change.
Good idea. Take a couple of weeks off, get some sun, take Jonah fishing.
No, real change. A new city. A place where every time I go around a corner, I don't think of Maggie.
And like a real change, like a new city. And we discover his wife was Maggie. Mm-hmm. And we see them outside Wrigley Field, which I've not been in Wrigley Field before, but I've been in this general area. There's a really, really good ice cream place right over to the left. If you ever are there, try it out. I can't remember what it's called, but it's really good.
Excuse me, where is the ice cream to the left?
And this is Carrie Lowell, and this was fairly early in her career. She had done A License to Kill. I'll talk more about her when we get to the end of all of it. And basically, the coworker's like, well, where would you go? And he's thinking of Seattle.
And now we have Susie and Greg are with Jonah and Sam in the airport. So I guess they're going to Seattle. I guess we've made that. They're doing some Charlotte York timeline, and they're going to Seattle. And Susie's trying to talk to Sam about dating and saying in a few months he'll start dating. And Sam says, it just doesn't happen twice. And then credits.
So in the commentary, this is where I found out that Victor Garber is Tom Hanks's character's brother.
Okay. And that is his wife, though.
Which all makes sense. Yes. And that's his wife. But it was that funny thing where I'm like, I love that it took the commentary for me to find out what the relationship was here. But anyways, there we go. Yes. So Victor Garber's character is Tom Hanks's character's brother. And yes, we get an opening credit sequence to As Time Goes By, which I always assumed was called A Kiss Is Just a Kiss.
Well, this is Jimmy Durante singing. And I knew it was As Time Goes By because I did perform on a dinner train when I was in college. That was one of my jobs. I've talked about it before. And we did this thing where it was like, guess the song, and we would have to sing the unknown intro, and then you would guess the song, and this was one of our songs.
Interesting. Yeah, it was news to me, and I didn't write a whole lot about the people in the opening credits, other than I wrote that, Mark Shaiman's going to be around.
Yeah, I wrote, Rosie O'Donnell, David Hyde Pierce, Mark Shaiman, who we know from many things, but for this podcast specifically, When Harry Met Sally and Bros, and then I wrote, I'm sorry, but a Nora Ephron film immediately makes me feel cozy.
It does. And I just wrote, we have a map of the continental United States that starts to emerge. And this was a Nora idea, that she had a vision in her mind of like, we're going to see this map. We're going to use the map from time to time to sort of trace where people are headed. Mm-hmm. And now we're in Baltimore 18 months later. And this was originally supposed to be Pittsburgh, but Nora wanted it to be further east. She wanted to kind of get them as far away from each other as possible without it being New York.
Okay. And our friend Eric said they could not use his house in Pittsburgh, so they had to reroute shooting.
Correct. This was their backup. And now we have Bill Pullman and Meg Ryan. And Bill Pullman at this point had done, I mean, I love Spaceballs, so I had to put that in there. He had also done The Accidental Tourist, which is a film that I've never seen, even though it's Gina Davis's Academy Award winning film. And then he had just previously done A League of Their Own with Tom Hanks. Mm. And he would be in a movie called Summersby that comes out this same year. And Summersby is that film that it doesn't matter how many times I see it, I can never remember how it ends.
You're also like that with Howard's End, aren't you?
Howard's End, I just don't get. Oh, like, okay. A thing happens at the very end that I'm like, I don't know what just happened. Summersby is all like the crux of it of like, is he or is he not the person he says that he is? And literally every time I watch it, I'm surprised again. Every single time I'm like, oh, I didn't see that coming.
How fun for you.
Yeah. So Meg Ryan's immediate follow-up to When Harry Met Sally had been Joe versus the Volcano with Tom Hanks. And then she'd done like a more dramatic role with The Doors.
Not the Jim Morrison Doors. The movie was called,
yes,
The Doors.
Yeah, the movie The Doors.
Is it about The Doors?
It is.
Oh, are The Doors in it? No, they're dead.
Yes, Val Kilmer plays
Jim Morrison.
Is that his name? I'm blanking on it now.
I hope it's not, because this will be a fun...
Wait.
Jim Morrison, yeah. Heck yes.
Yeah, good job.
You're welcome.
Elise knows all about pop culture.
I know things about, I know a lot of things about, like, music pre-2000. My dad, we used to watch Rock and Roll Jeopardy when it was on, and there were episodes where my dad did not miss one question.
Wow.
Yeah, so they are loading up the car with presents for Christmas, and Walter, aka Bill Pullman, is recapping Annie's family to remember who they are. I actually did this. I sent Mark, my boyfriend, a cheat sheet before we went to our friend Jesse's birthday party the other day. Not that he doesn't remember things, but sometimes it's hard to remember, like, oh yeah, this person, I met this and they were doing this, and just so like things are easier, you know?
Oh, I'm the worst at it. Like, yeah. I have the worst memory for names and how I met someone, and who I'm the worst at, like, who knows who. Also, I'm always like, have you two met? And they're like, yeah, we all worked together. And right. I'm like, yes, I know.
Yeah,
like that happens all the time.
Yeah.
And yeah, they're taking separate cars to get somewhere, and I'm guessing it's Christmas.
Well, because they have all these presents, and they're talking about like family things, and someone in Annie's family threatened to kill the dog, and I don't like that person. Yeah, they have matching cars, it looks like, but I think they're just cars from that time period.
Sure.
And as they're getting out of the car, when they arrive where they're going, they can't mention the IRS around someone.
Yes, there's a lot of that. And a lot of like me then later on being like, oh, you're the... I feel like it was the second time that I watched it that I was like, oh, that's who they were talking about. And that... So there are certain characters that I don't really talk about because I didn't know who they were at this point. So if you bring it up, you bring it up. If not, we have a lot of characters to meet.
Yeah, Mike and I always joke when we start taking notes on these that the first 15 minutes take me over an hour, because that's when you're meeting all the characters, everything's getting started, everything's happening, and then it starts to ease up a little bit.
And if you don't really know the film already, you don't know who's important and who isn't, so right. You end up like just writing everyone down, and I had enough of a familiarity that I knew some of the characters we'd see again and some that we wouldn't. But yeah, I will also say that the only direction Nora gave Meg was that her character was a Republican who had never had an orgasm, and I don't 100% know what that means or what that means for the character, but Nora said it to me, so I thought I should say it to you.
And I see it.
Meg took that note.
And I'm not saying any, I'm saying more that she gives that virginal look, and the quote unquote Republican part, I think it's just she comes from like a more conservative family, you know?
Sure, absolutely.
So yeah, so we find out now that he's meeting her family for the first time. And very quickly, as we get to the dinner where the family's sitting, Annie announces that she and Walter are engaged.
Yeah, I will say, like, as a directorial thing, I think it's funny because we have an unseen figure that says that Annie has an announcement. And I do think that, like, if we'd had reshoots, we would have seen that person say the line because it's a strange off-screen moment. But yeah, Walter and her are engaged. And we have David Hyde Pierce there, and he had already done, like, he'd done Little Man Tate and The Fisher King, but minus the Hyde. He'd just been David Pierce at that point.
Okay, and he plays Dennis, who we know is in the family. Where? We don't know yet.
Yeah, we'll find out.
We also have Valerie Wright playing Betsy. Now, Valerie is a Broadway veteran, done a ton of stuff, but most recently, and when you look at her, you'll be like, this makes perfect sense. She was the standby for Victoria Clark in Kimberly Akimbo. But she has also been in many, many shows. Important to me, the original production of Steel Pier.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Not that there was a revival of Steel Pier, but there should be.
There should be.
We have Tom Tammy as Harold. And we have Frances Conroy as Irene, who we know from many, many things. I mostly know her from, isn't she like the Balenciaga from American Horror Story?
From American Horror Story, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, Walter starts sneezing and Frances Conroy hopes he's okay. And we find out that Walter is allergic to everything.
Yeah, Walter sneezing all over the food. And then we find out he has a lot of allergies. And I just wrote, is he going to die from a nut allergy right here? Like, is he just going to die?
Because we are told that a tiny bit of nut will kill him.
In this moment, in my version of Sleepless in Seattle, he was going to eat something, die, and then Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks were both going to be widowed.
Ah, okay. You went darker.
Mm-hmm. In my version, Nick Castle would have directed it. He would have said, that's what I want to see.
Absolutely. And I will say that it's funny because we'd had the mention about Uncle Milton, how he'd been in prison, and then they sort of say, like, we should have champagne, but when did we use that? Oh, we used it for Uncle Milton's parole, and he's there, and it was delicious.
Yeah, and we find out Harold is allergic to bees, and all this allergy talk makes me feel like us trying to plan a menu for movie night, because all of our friends have, like, you know, Jesse can't have dairy, soy, nuts, pea protein, Mike can't have gluten. Like, it's just like a whole list of things, and I just end up always bringing a rotisserie chicken. Yeah, and then Walter starts to glitch a little bit. He needs a reboot. Oh, that's a Lou Gehrig line.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was, but it's apparently a Lou Gehrig reference. And I will also say that Calvin Trillin is the man who plays Uncle Milton.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of only four acting credits, and he's a writer friend of Nora Ephron's. So she likes to put him in things.
Yeah. And then David Hyde Pierce says, I would like to propose a toast, and I can't not follow that with, here's to the ladies.
Yeah,
who lunch.
It's hard to not.
Anytime I hear that. And then we have her grandmother, we have her mother showing her grandmother's dress to her. And who is the mother played by?
So her name is spelt LeClancher Durand. LeClancher Durand. She's an interesting character actress, and she had already done Awakenings, which I feel like is a film that we've talked about for various reasons.
Yeah.
Well, she was born in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
and she did a smattering of work around this time, and then kind of went away for a while, and then came back in like 2015 to be in the film Bridge of Spies, and then had a couple episodes in the TV series Younger. So she's done stuff. I don't know a ton about her, though. It's basically her saying the Historic Society wanted this and I would never give it to them. And it does make me wonder who Grandma was.
Well, I got the impression that they were all like society people and maybe a little rich. So that's what I thought.
Sure.
Maybe that's what was happening. And they're in some sort of attic and she's telling her mom how they met. This all seems very strange. Like, the family's never met this person. They've never asked questions, but they're getting married. But it was 30 years ago.
Listen, we're going to get to more of that in a second. Because first of all, I like the character saying that he's a great athlete. Meg Ryan made that up, and so they put it in. But I think it's funny, and I wonder if that's to counterbalance all of his allergies. They were like, let's give him this thing that he's also a really great athlete. And then they're headed down to D.C. tonight to be with his parents Christmas morning. But that also feels like weird information to tell your mother on Christmas Eve.
Right. Like, wouldn't she know that you guys weren't staying that long or something? And she's telling them how they met, and their lettuce and tomato sandwiches got switched up, and somehow he was allergic to wheat bread, but not white bread. I don't understand why.
That didn't make any sense to
me. Right. And then they met each other because they both like lettuce and tomato sandwiches with nothing else on it. I don't know. And she makes a comment, you make a million decisions that mean nothing and then one that changes your life, which gets her and her mother into a conversation about destiny. And Annie says destiny isn't real, just accidents. And her mom is thinking, yeah, it is real, bitch. No one else is ordering your weird ass sandwich. That's what I wrote. And this is all very serendipity.
Yeah. And she has the line of destiny is something we invented because we can't stand the fact that everything that happens is accidental. And then we get to the mom telling the story of meeting Cliff, who was a waiter in Atlantic City, and going for a walk on the pier and holding hands and not knowing where one hand had ended and the other began. And she brings up magic.
Yeah. He was a waiter that wasn't supposed to work that day, but he did. And I thought, Mike, you should always go into work on your days off. You might find love.
Perfect.
Yeah. Mom says she knew it was magic. Annie seems terrified. She just kind of gives her mom this look. And then her mom says, I knew your dad and I would have great sex. Ew.
Well, yeah, we have an interesting conversation about things taking a while to work in the sack, but that things are working for Walter and Annie like clockwork. And we see the dress. It's a fairly simple design for a dress.
And then she hugs her mom and rips the dress. And it's a sign, but she doesn't believe in signs.
Yeah, it's funny that Annie says it's a sign, and the mom rightly points out that Annie doesn't believe in signs. And now they're leaving, and they all love you, and they all love each other, and did anyone ever call you anything other than Walter? Because the mother had brought up in the previous scene that Walter is such a formal name, and I think this is maybe Annie looking for something?
Maybe, and also just thinking of, like, a little baby Walter. That's funny to me. And then they're leaving, and Annie realizes she forgot Walter's stepmother's present inside, and tells him not to wait. She'll be 10 minutes behind him. And I thought something must happen in the house, because what's going to take 10 minutes? She just has to run in and grab it. That didn't make sense to me, but nothing happens. And then it shows her in the car. This Roy Rogers version of Sleigh Ride is playing, and it's like horses, 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 horses.
Yeah, I wrote there's a lot of horses, but I also had to make up a story in my mind as to why the stepmother's present had been taken into the house in the first place. Wouldn't they have just left it in the car?
I don't know. Or if it was brought in, like maybe they brought them all in.
That's what
and
I went with.
As they
that
were
was,
unpacking them.
That was
them,
what I made up in my mind.
She said, oh shit, this one's your stepmother's. I'll have to remember
100%.
To bring them.
Yeah, that's what I did. That's what I settled on. And
yeah, now so
and yeah,
she's
yeah.
Oh, sorry. After Horses, 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 she's over that song. Now she's listening to Welcome to Your Emotions. And then she changes to You and Your Spleen. Spleens are important, Mike. I had mono. And now, coming up, Jingle Bells backwards. And then she goes back to Welcome to Your Emotions.
This is voiced by Caroline Aaron. She had already done the movies Heartburn and Working Girl and quite a bit of Woody Allen film, which we don't hold it against her. But she had also been in This Is My Life. So she got cast from this because she had done Nora Ephron's previous film.
Is it Heartburn, Nora Ephron?
Was written by Nora Ephron, yes. Heartburn was written by Nora Ephron, I believe directed by Mike Nichols. And I didn't write it here, but I don't put her in my, like, later on they went on to, but she will be in Sex and the City. She will play Samantha's realtor.
Yes, yes. I have that written in
who
here.
She asks, yeah, who she asked to never, to. She asked Samantha to not ever go to another real estate person. So that's who this is. And she's broadcasting from Chicago, and it's What's Your Wish This Christmas Eve? And Annie's wish is, yes, to change the station. And we have a couple of, I think they put in the worst options on purpose of, like, You and Your Spleen. And I will say that the subtitles just say Jingle Bells Sung Backwards by the New Jersey, and then it cuts off, but there's another word and I don't know what it is.
Sung by the New Jersey, Kate Mayette.
So if anyone can, like, decipher what that full title is, I would appreciate it. Yeah, we're back with Dr. Fieldstone, and Jonah is on the line. And so this is where I wrote about Ross Mallinger, because I didn't write about most people until I found out who their names were sometimes. And he worked a ton in the 90s. He had done 90210. He'd done Kindergarten Cop. He'd done Roseanne. And yeah, he says his name, which I think gets bleeped out because no last names and you sound young, and he's 8. And she asks why he's up so late. And he points out that it's not that late in Seattle.
What's interesting about this is that he says, hi, my name is Jonah from, and then they bleep. So they don't actually bleep out his last name. They just bleep out where he's from, which is also important for, You shouldn't be giving your location as an 8-year-old.
Do they? Because they know that they're from Seattle because they become Sleepless in Seattle.
Well, I don't know. But Jonah calls in and he thinks his dad needs a new wife.
And I wrote, this is a very sad, sweet conversation.
Yes.
And basically, Dr. Fieldstone says that in order to help, she would need to talk with the dad. And Annie calls her a wretched woman and tells Jonah to hang up, you know, through the radio.
Yeah, why is she so mad?
Yeah, I don't know. She's not on Dr. Fieldstone's side here. Mm-hmm. And he says that if he gets yelled at, he's never going to listen to the show again. So can we talk about the house really quickly?
Sure.
Because we're in a boathouse. I don't understand a boathouse. And I will say that in a very related film that came out a year previously, Madonna's erotic thriller, Body of Evidence, she also lives in a houseboat. And was that a thing in this moment, that people were really into houseboats in the mid to early 90s?
And waterbeds.
They just seem impractical to me.
What is the line from that movie that Eric always quotes on his podcast?
The women hate me, they think I'm a whore. And the men see a cold, heartless bitch they can pay back for every chick who ever blew them off in a bar. Hey, I did that pretty good.
That was, I don't know if that was the one, but I like that one.
I can quote many things from Body of Evidence. I also like saying, I'm just trying to explain myself.
There was something about an animal, something about being an animal.
Have you ever seen animals make
yes,
love?
Yes, that's it.
It's violent, but they never really hurt each other. I know that I've told the story of when my mom brought Body of Evidence home as a treat for the two of us to watch together, clearly having no idea that it was an erotic thriller. And A, I had to pretend like I'd never seen it before, because how would I have seen it? I wasn't old enough to rent this video. But B, I always think about how we got to the end. And my mom's biggest complaint about Body of Evidence was, she said, I don't like that they use the term making love. They weren't making love. They were having sex.
Yes, you have told this story. And then what's the movie that she wouldn't let you watch because there was adultery in it? And I was like, what? I don't remember. Anyway.
Oh, right. Anyway.
So, yeah, and
so we're on a houseboat. I guess we'll just get
past
it.
We're on a houseboat. I have a lot of concerns. I'm worried about this houseboat flooding. I'm worried why they keep going outside, because isn't it cold in Seattle in December? But I don't really know. So Jonah goes to get his dad. Sam thinks that it's someone on the phone selling things, but then she tells him what's happening. And of course, Sam can't be mad because Jonah is sweet and this is Jonah's Christmas wish. And now Sam and Annie are both saying the same things out loud to Dr. Marcia.
Yes. Your son feels that since your wife's death, you've been deeply unhappy. And she asks him to talk to her, saying that it's his Christmas wish. And I like that he thinks that her first name might just be Doctor, which is pretty funny. She says that she doesn't want to invade his privacy, and both Annie and Sam say, sure you do. So yeah, this is them sort of beginning to have a conversation together without realizing it.
Yeah, and she asks, Dr. Marcia asks Sam if he sleeps at night, and Jonah says he doesn't sleep at all. And Sam lets us know that Maggie loved Christmas, and it's tough this time of year.
And Jonah needs a mother.
And Dr. Marcia says, could it be you need someone just as much as Jonah does? And Annie says, yes.
And they're going to go to break. And when they come back, others will be calling in. And this is where we get Sleepless in Seattle, that the doctor gives him that nickname.
Right. If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Sleepless in Seattle.
And Sam says this is going to be real fun and helpful. And we do have a moment now at what on our screens looks to be the Capitol Diner. And this is kind of a fascinating story. Did you look into this at all?
I mean, I know who the actresses are.
So this location is actually called the Hollywood Diner, and it's in downtown Baltimore. So Barry Levinson, when he was directing his film called Diner, he had a very specific look that he wanted, and it was basically a diner that reminded him of his childhood, or like the diner that he had gone to in his youth. But that particular diner had been turned into a liquor store, and the other diner that was nearby wouldn't allow him to film there. So there was an empty lot across that he thought would be a great location. And basically, they found this diner at a New Jersey diner graveyard. Do I know exactly what that is? I do not. But apparently it's a place where they take like portable diners when they're no longer being used. And so they had it shipped out. It was originally Long Island's Westbury Grill. And they had this diner shipped out, and then it was going to be sent back to New Jersey. In fact, I think that it was. But basically, like, the mayor of Baltimore, like, went on this crusade to get this diner brought back. So it was eventually opened as a diner, and it was a diner that, like, served the youth, or, like, the school kids of the area would, like, go there to learn vocations, and also it's where they would have, like, outings. And then eventually it did become a legit diner, which closed in, I believe, 2012, and it's still sitting there. Like, you can still go up and look in the window, and it looks just like it looks in this film, but it hasn't been a functioning diner in over a decade. So there you go.
Thank you. Uh-huh. And they still use it for movies or no?
They still use it for movies. Things still, like, the wire shot a scene there.
Okay, because I remember there was actually a diner on the Upper West Side that was vacant that they kept, and they shot a lot of Maisel there.
Yes. I feel like they maybe shot some Pose there too.
Yeah, so we have two actresses playing the waitresses. We have LaTanya Richardson as Harriet, and who has done many things as an actress and a producer, but she is also the wife of Samuel L. Jackson. And not that I'm going to put someone's husband in front of their work, but I just find it interesting because we are also with Linda Wallum, who is also a writer and producer and the wife of Melissa Etheridge. So I just think it's interesting that there's, like, two people that are married to two also very famous people, and they have not large parts, but they are waitresses at the diner talking about the radio show. And Annie steps in and orders tea with the bag out, which feels very Sally in this moment, like a very specific thing. And we find out the world is captivated by Sam.
Yeah, I will say that at this point, Linda Wallum, yeah, she is more of a writer-producer. She had written for and appeared on The Carol Burnett Show, but not the one you're thinking of, the one that only lasted 7 episodes. Also appearing on that show was Rick Aviles, who was in Ghost.
Yeah.
Anyway, just a random little crossover there.
Willie Lopez.
Yes. And at this point, LaTanya Jackson had already done Fried Green Tomatoes, Malcolm X, and Lorenzo's Oil. Many other things, too, but those were the ones that popped out for me. I will say that Harriet is less charmed than Loretta is. Harriet thinks that Sleepless in Seattle probably smells and doesn't cover his food in the fridge, because apparently that's a thing that they think about. I don't know if it's that West Coasters or people in Seattle. It's a strange personality trait that Harriet thinks that he might have.
I mean, it makes sense because things in refrigerators absorb smells, and if you're not covering your food, bacteria can get into it, etc. But Mike comes from a family who doesn't believe in expiration dates. So
that is very true.
Yeah, so the world is captivated by Sam. Sam doesn't know if he's going to find someone else, and he's just focusing on getting up in the morning. And then Dr. Marcia says, "Sam, tell me what was so special about your wife." And Sam says, How long is your program?
Oh, well, it was a million tiny little things. If when you added them all up, it just meant that we were supposed to be together. And I knew it. And I knew it the very first time I touched her. It was like coming home, only to know home I'd ever known. I was just taking her hand to help her out of a car. And I knew it. It was like
magic.
And in this moment, I thought that Annie realizes that Walter is not magic.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it is pointed out by Nora that Meg Ryan has all of these moments where you see the doubt wash over her face, but she's so good at playing it that you're almost like, is that what's happening? Like, is she becoming more aware that she's maybe not on the right path? And then the show is over and, you know, let us know how things go. And he says you can count on it. And I think to myself, he's probably not ever going to call this show again.
No.
So there you go. For $4 a month, you get access to everything we've recorded, and we put out new material pretty much every week. You can find us on the Patreon app by searching We Couldn't Help But Wonder, the link on our Instagram, or through our website, wecouldn'thelpbutwonder.com. You'll also get instructions on how to receive the episodes wherever you already listen to podcasts. Hope you join us.
Maybe I made this up. Maybe I didn't write anything.
Maybe you dreamed her.
Maybe I dreamed of her. I dreamt of Mandalay. Okay, sorry. Now I'm going to Rebecca. All right, sorry. That was a really awful thing that I just did. And they're in some sort of addict. They're inside of an addict. No, they're in an attic. This is actually voiced by Nora Ephron.
It's not. Something later is voiced by Nora Ephron, but this
is not voiced by Nora Ephron. They end up, that is like what they actually bleached out. That is actually what they bleep
out. They bleached
out.
It.
Yeah, and Jonah calls in and he thinks his dad needs a new one.